54. Some Things Never Happen. The gunsmith cat's alarm watch taped to the wall of Laney's box brings him home from the walled city. It buzzes to announce the suit's impending arrival. The suit has no watch of his own, but is relentlessly punctual, his rounds timed to the clocks of the subway, which are set in turn by radio from an atomic clock in Nagoya. Laney tastes blood. It is a long time since he has brushed his teeth, and they feel artificial and ill-fitting, as though in his absence they have been replaced with a stranger's. He spits into a bottle kept for this purpose, and considers attempting the journey to the restroom. Importance of grooming. He feels the stubble on his cheeks, calculating the effort required to remove it. He could request that the suit obtain an electric disposable, but really he prefers a blade. He is one of those men who has never grown a beard, not even briefly. And now, some small voice, one always best ignored, suggests he never will. He hears the old man in the next box say something in Japanese, and knows that the suit has arrived. He wonders what model the old man is building now, and sees in his mind's eye, with hallucinatory clarity, the finishing touches being put on a model of Colin Laney. It is a garage kit, this Laney kit, a limited run produced for only the most serious of enthusiasts, the otaku of plastic model kits, and as such it is molded from styrene of a quite nauseous mauve. The plastic used in garage kits tends to uniformly ghastly shades, as the enthusiast manufacturers know that no kit assembled will ever remain unpainted. The Laney the old man is detailing is an earlier Laney, the Laney of his days in L.A., when he worked as a quantitative analyst for Slit Scan, a tabloid television show of quite monumental viciousness. This Laney wears Padanian designer clothing, and sports a very expensive pair of sunglasses, the frames of which are even now being picked out in silver by the old man's narrowest sable, scarcely more than a single hair. But this waking dream is broken now by the advent of the suit's head, his hair like the molded pompadour of some archaic mannequin. Laney feels rather than sees the precision with which the suit's black eyeglass frames have been most recently mended, and as the suit crawls in beneath the flap of melon blanket, Laney smells the rancid staleness the suit's clothing exudes. It is strange that any odor produced by a warm body should suggest intense cold, but the suit's somehow does. The suit is bringing Laney more of the blue syrup, more Regain, several large chocolate bars laden with sucrose and caffeine, and 2 liters of generic cola. The suit's painted shirt front seems faintly self-luminous, like the numerals of a diver's watch glimpsed far down in the depth of a lightless well, a sacrificial cenote, perhaps, and Laney finds himself adrift for just an instant in fragments of some half-remembered Yucatan vacation. Something is wrong, Laney thinks. Something is wrong with his eyes, because now the suit's luminous shirt glows with the light of 1,000 suns, and all the rest is black, the black of old negatives. And still somehow he manages to give the suit 2 more of the untraceable debit chips, and even to nod at the suit's tense little salaryman bow, executed kneeling amid sleeping bags and candy wrappers, and then the suit is gone. And the glare of his shirt. Surely that was just some artifact of whatever process this is that Laney is here to pursue. Laney drinks half of one of the bottles of cough syrup, chews and swallows 1/3 of one of the candy bars, and washes this down with a swallow of the lukewarm cola. When he closes his eyes, even before he puts the iPhones on, he seems to plunge into the flow of data. Immediately, he is aware of Libya and Paco directing him. They do not bother to speak or to present, but he knows them now by a certain signature, a style of navigation. He lets them take him where they will, and of course he is not disappointed. A lozenge opens before him. He is looking down into what he takes to be Harwood's office in San Francisco. At Harwood, seated behind a vast, dark desk, littered with architectural models and stacks of printout. Harwood holding a telephone handset.
"It's an absurd launch," Harwood said. "But then it's an insane service. It works because it's redundant, understand? It's too dumb not to work."
Lainey does not hear the reply, and takes this to mean that Libya and Paco have hacked a security camera in the ceiling of Harwood's office. The audio is ambient sound, not a phone tap. Now Harwood rolls his eyes.
"People are fascinated by the pointlessness of it. That's what they like about it. Yes, it's crazy, but it's fun. You want to send your nephew in Houston a toy and you're in Paris? You buy it, take it to a Lucky Dragon, and have it recreated from the molecules up in a Lucky Dragon in Houston."
"What? What happens to the toy you bought in Paris?"
"You keep it. Give it away. Eviscerate it with your teeth, you tedious, literal-minded bitch."
"What?
No, I didn't." "No, I'm sorry, Noriko. That must be an artifact of your translation program. How could you imagine I'd say that?"
Harwood stares straight ahead, stunned with boredom.
"Of course I want to give the interview. This is an exclusive, after all, and you are my first choice."
Harwood smiles as he calms the journalist, but the smile vanishes the instant she begins to ask her next question.
"People are frightened of nanotechnology, Noriko. We know that. Even in Tokyo, 17.8% of your markedly techno-fetishistic populace refuses to this day to set foot in a nanotech structure. Here on the coast, I'd point to the example of Malibu, where there's been a very serious biotech accident, but one which is entirely unrelated to nanotech. It's actually being cleaned up with a combination of 3 smart algae, but everyone's convinced that the beaches are alive with invisible nanobots waiting to crawl up your disagreeable pussy."
"What?
Unfriendly cat?"
"No.
There's something wrong with your software, Noriko. And I do hope you're only writing this down because we negotiated the interview on a non-recorded basis. If any of this ever turns up in any recorded form at all, you'll not be getting another."
"What?
Good. I'm glad you do."
Harwood yawned silently.
"One last question, then."
Harwood listens, pursing his lips.
"Because Lucky Dragon is about convenience. Lucky Dragon is about being able to purchase those things you need, really need, when you need them, 24/7. But Lucky Dragon is also about fun, and people are going to have fun with these units. We've done enough research that we know that we don't really know what exactly Lucky Dragon customers will find to do with this technology, but that's all part of the fun."
Harwood explored the recesses of his left nostril with the nail of his little finger, but seemed to find nothing of interest.
"Blow me," he said. "Inflate?"
"I don't think so, Noriko, but I'd have that software checked if I were you. Bye."
Harwood puts the phone down, stares straight ahead. It rings. He picks it up, listens, frowns.
"Why doesn't that surprise me? Why doesn't that surprise me in the least?"
He looks to Lainey as if he's on the verge of laughing.
"Well, you can try. You can certainly try. Please do. But if you can't, then he'll kill you. All of you. Every last one. But I shouldn't worry about that, should I? Because I've got your brochure here, and it's really a wonderful brochure. Printed in Geneva. Spare no expense in presentation. Full color. Heavy stock. And it assures me that I've hired the best, the very best. And I really do believe that you are the best. We did shop comparatively. But I also know that he is what he is. And God help you."
Harwood hangs up. Lainey feels Libya and Paco tugging at him, urging him elsewhere. He wishes that he could stay here with Harwood. He wishes that he and Harwood could sit opposite one another across that desk and share their experience of the nodal apprehension. He would love, for instance, to hear Harwood's interpretation of the Node of 1911. He would like to be able to discuss the Lucky Dragon nano facsimile launch with Harwood. He imagines himself sending a replica of the garage kit Lainey, though sending isn't the word here. But where? And to whom? Libya and Paco tug him to the place where that thing is growing. And he sees that it has changed. He wonders if Harwood has looked at it recently. The shape of a new world, if any world can be said to be new. And he wonders if he will ever have the chance to speak with Harwood. He doubts it. Some things never happen, he reminds himself. But this one always does, says the still small voice of mortality. Blow me, Lainey tells it.